Midnight Lands is a Morin Academy podcast about the past, present, and future of Catholicism.
For our first episode, we're honored to have on Dr. Matthew Dal Santo. He's an associate professor of church history and dogmatics at St. Patrick's Seminary in Menlo Park, California, and the author of Debating the Saints' Cult in the Age of Gregory the Great and the forthcoming Theocratia, Nicholas II and a Russian Political Theology. He's also a co-founder of the Simone Weil Center for Political Philosophy. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Spencer, for having me.
Yeah, so we're officially here to talk about an article you published in last year's spring issue of Communio.
Right.
And that's called A Theological Reading of the Russian Regime, Sergei Bulgakov and the Theocratic Principle in 1917 and Today. And in the introduction of that, you write, following the unashamedly essentialist, because Christian Platonic thought of the Russian Orthodox theologian and philosopher of history, Father Sergei Bulgakov, this essay seeks to give a modest answer to the questions of what sort of regime exists in Russia and what are its foundations. So what sort of regime does exist in Russia? What are its foundations?
Well, as I describe in the essay, the regime that exists in Russia, as I understand it, and by regime, I don't mean merely the formal constitutional arrangements of Russia. I mean the way in which power is imagined as working in Russia, where it comes from, and what kind of purpose it has. The regime that I, the cultural regime of politics that I understand exists in Russia is what I would call sub-theocratic, or both sub- and post-theocratic at the same time. And by that I mean that Russian culture seems to remain deeply aware and impressed with the sense that power is, political power, the act of ruling, is a participation in what in Eastern Orthodox theology would be described as a divine energy or a divine activity. It's something that has its origins in God and which man participates in a secondary way. It is not something that man constructs for himself, or that man therefore is free to attribute any meaning he likes to. Its meaning is, in fact, given. It's given by God in his act of, well, God is the one who rules first, ordering the world according to a certain pattern of fixed meaning, hence the Christian essentialist. The world that results is therefore not free. It's not up for man to renegotiate or reinterpret or deconstruct or reconstruct. It's simply a given. And man's task as man lies precisely in trying to, in conforming this world which God has placed under his royal authority, of conforming it to the heavenly archetype, God's original and final intention for it. And so and then for that reason, what strikes many people, especially on the left or even on the liberal right in the West, as instances of Russian authoritarianism, or worse, you know, a kind of proto-fascist dictatorship, is on one level, and I think theologically speaking, actually an expression of this sense of the world's fixedness, that the world is not man's to recreate according to his own free will. And that there is therefore also a theological difference and a theological background to the inability of Russia and the West really to understand each other on the political plane.
Because would it be fair to say that you view modern Western liberal societies as fundamentally cut off from being sub-theocratic or post-theocratic because of
Yes, I see modern Western politics as fundamentally voluntarist. It's rooted in the will, a will that is entirely sovereign and free. It's not rooted in any order of being that's greater than itself, any order of being that can articulate an illegitimate claim of allegiance over it. No, the will has to be free and untrammeled. If not, it's a form of oppression. If not, it's fascism. And the reasons for that are of long standing, I think, in Western civilization. But on the other hand, it's also a fairly recent phenomenon, because I would say that until recently, even a country like the United States, which whose formal constitution exists on very voluntarist foundations, I think, nonetheless, assumed that that act of, that the people's free act of will would take place within a world of certain given meanings. I think that if we were to try to step back into the fundamentally Calvinistic world of the framers of the United States Constitution, yes, they would have understood God's relationship to the world as operating primarily on the basis of will, but there was still an awful lot that was given, therefore, about the world as a result of that. So yes, I think in the West, in the United States, but also in other countries, as you can hear, I'm not American. I'm Australian. And in principle, a sovereign who reigns by the grace of God is still the sovereign of Australia. And in that sense, the modern British political regime is in principle more theocratic than Russia's, because it actually does locate the origins of rule in God. Practically, however, in Britain, in Australia, in the United States, and almost everywhere in Europe, where I've spent most of the last 20 years living, the logic of modern Western politics and society is the same, and it's a logic of voluntarism that realizes itself in an ever greater emancipation from anything like given being or the givenness of being.
Okay. So can I briefly recap your argument to make sure I'm understanding you? So would it be fair to say the division between how you're laying out the contrast of the secular West and the post sub-theocratic Russia, maybe even, is in sometimes in the West, even when in principle we're under some sort of king, monarch, theocracy, in practice we're not, whereas in Russia, in principle, they are not, but in practice, they still are. Like you bring up how both Orthodoxy, Islam, Yellow Hat Buddhism, is that your argument that in practice, people there are, even if
Exactly.
they're not?
It is. That's my argument. Yeah.
So
That
then.
the Russian constitutional regime is in principle entirely secular. It's entirely secular and entirely voluntaristic, in as much as it locates sovereignty with the people and attributes to them the free act of electing a president to implement whatever political policies the people happen to endorse, without reference to any kind of cosmic order or given any given natural law. In reality, however, I think politics in Russia hews closely to a sense of cosmic order, and that in fact is the real, perhaps often subliminal, source of the president's authority.
So, if we can park it here and do a thought experiment for a second, let's imagine this podcast we're doing goes viral. Everybody's talking about it everywhere. People realize in practice we need to ground our society in some sort of theocratic principle. How would American life be changed? Even
That's a very good question. Because
I'm interested in this
American life
because
would be changed. American life would be changed, I think, in this way. Americans would come to see themselves and their polity, their nation, even the very landscape and earth around them, as existing as part of a cosmos that is itself gift, and an orderly hierarchy of symbols that are in each of them sort of a theophany. That everything that surrounds us is part of a cosmic order whose purpose is to impart to us, to open our eyes to the existence of God and his goodness. That would be the first thing. We would come to realize that our everyday lives, but also our national political lives, took place in the setting of this cosmic order. Observing this cosmic order, we would then begin to observe that it's held together not by accident or chance or a series of relationships that can be explained by mere force or act of will, but it's held together in a way that is best explained by the notion of the logos. It's ordered and it's arranged in a way that is for man's providential good and for the good of all creatures that exist here, and that it is lovely, it's desirable. And it's lovely and desirable because the one who orders it is himself the source of all that's lovely and desirable. So there would be both an understanding that the world is some kind of an icon of the divine character, but also a longing for the one who is the fashioner, so to speak, of this icon. So there would be a longing for the logos. And this longing for the logos would then inform the way we organized ourselves politically. So even before it's even before you begin to talk about what kind of regime we should live under, I think the more important question is, what are we living for, and what kind of world is it that we're living in?
Right. And then once, let's say, some wider revival happened, would it be fair to say what that third point kind of looks like, at least to bring in Catholic social teaching? Would it be almost fair to summarize it as like chains of patriarchal subsidiarity? Patriarchal in the sense of like a theocratic principle that every layer of at least human society would be ordered like a family with like a head in charge. Ultimately guiding it and in solidarity with chains b above and b below it.
I think that that's actually broadly right. And I think that that's broadly right if we understand patriarchal there to mean the rule of one who is father and king. And where both of those terms receive their meaning and significance not from earthly fathers or earthly kings, but from the one who is the archetype of both of those things, and of whom earthly fathers and earthly kings are only inadequate reflections. So yes, if we began to translate that vision, so to speak, that cosmic vision into a social order, it would be hierarchically arranged, yes, and it'd be hierarchically arranged under the authority of figures who were capable of imaging God's own character as father and king.
Right. And then put another way, this is adjacent to Agustín Del Noche's contention that power is different than authority. And they would have genuine authority and therefore be able to be loved, right?
That's right. They would have genuine authority and be able to be loved because their place in the hierarchy is a function of their ability to image God's own character. And it's the loveliness of God's own character which is then manifest in their own image of that character that makes people ideally wish to submit to their authority without coercion being necessary.
Sure. Right. And part of why this is so interesting to me is I've been on this both converting to Catholicism journey, but also part of that has been in the last few years, especially kind of despairing of liberal democracy being able to furnish solutions that in any fundamental way solve the problems of American society. And I've kind of been dragged, partly because I'm absorbing all this Catholic stuff, and also partly because of that disillusionment. I've been kind of pulled kicking and screaming into some sort of abstract, like monarchist position. American context, I realize, is kind of farcical because you're in this position of like, what does it mean to be a monarch? Or like, what would it mean to have a to want a monarch when you're not like you're not in Russia where there was a czar, or can't be a Carlist, or like a purely potential polity I would like to belong, I guess. But nevertheless, I've had my own kind of experience, like you talk about, Sergei Bulgakov having. This that's where it spoke to me, this section. I'll read it real quick. In the spring of 1909, the economist, philosopher, and later Orthodox priest and theologian Sergei Bulgakov went for a walk along the Yalta embankment. This was significant because on that day, for the first time in his life, Bulgakov saw Russia's Tsar Nicholas II, and in seeing him, Bulgakov tells us he, quote unquote, fell in love. It was an apocalypse, an epiphany, or revelation that caught Bulgakov completely by surprise. Only now, in this encounter from a distance with Nicholas II on the Yalta embankment, did Bulgakov believe he understood how Russia's prevailing political order, Tsarism, cohered rather than conflicted with its religion. As he himself put it, by some inward act of understanding, the strength of which orthodoxy gave me, he recalled, my attitude toward the Tsar's authority changed. I became, in the full meaning of the word, a Tsarist. I realized that in its essence, Tsarist authority is the highest kind of authority, and that this is not on account of its own name, but on account of God's. So I guess that speaks to me. How does that speak to you? How does that fit in, like, with your study, with your Catholicism?
Well, one day I would like to hear your description of your own sort of experience on the outer embankment. It's funny, maybe everybody of a certain kind of maybe a certain kind of person at a certain point in their conversion towards God have had a similar experience. I mean, I am very aware of having had one myself as a child when, and I don't want to sort of trivialize the conversation at this point, but I can remember very clearly having one when I was probably about 12 years old, and I went just out of, because it's the kind of thing children do, I just went fossicking through my grandparents' garage in suburban Australia, and I came across this box of newspaper clippings that my grandmother had put aside from the coronation, Queen Elizabeth II's coronation in 1953. And I mean, it was an entire box full. It was a lot of newspaper clippings. She'd really got into this. And I remember seeing a front page photograph, the famous Cecil Beaton photograph of the Queen as a very young and very beautiful young woman, decked out in all of the regalia of monarchy. Each of this regalia, of course, I now understand, having been created to a large extent by the church or under the supervision of the church for the use in a church service over centuries, it drips with theological meaning. And seeing this young woman decked in these symbols, I sort of, for the first instance, I think, understood that the world that I was living in, even the very sort of banal world of suburban Australia in the 1980s, was caught up in something much more magnificent, that there was a cosmic order, a glorious and a splendid cosmic order that radiated light towards us that would realize itself even in the, as I said, the fairly banal boundaries, limitations of my own little corner of the world. And although I had already been, subject to Sunday school and various things up to that point in time, I think it was actually that picture that made me help me actually made me understand that God was real. And I'm almost here lost the exact terms of your question, but something of the rest of my journey, so to speak, as a Christian, and in moving from the branch of Protestantism in which I was raised into the Catholic Church, and now, of course, teaching future theology to future Catholic priests, has been about trying to recover as completely as possible that, I think, fundamentally sacramental vision of the world that was first revealed to me in that moment.
Sure. Yeah, and I think where, at the very least, where it sounds like our intellectual journeys merge is part of what it means to come out of Protestantism is to rediscover a sacramental, at least church, if not total worldview.
Right.
I take the core of it to, if you lose that sacramental vision, then, to use anachronistic terms that came later, you're kind of in this existential situation where you have to hold on to your belief, but there's nowhere in the world where you can find it like validated and affirmed.
Right, or you exist merely, your Christianity becomes merely a form of idealism, something that you, an idea that you have to kind of constantly represent to yourself and ask yourself whether you, in this moment, still subscribe to it. And your whole spiritual drive really takes place in function in relation to this disembodied idea. Jesus died for my sins, and there's nothing I can do to save myself other than rely on him. Yeah, and that I think is, I mean, it's better than nothing. If you were to have a choice between being exposed to that and to being and hearing nothing about Jesus, then I think that's obviously better. But it is ultimately, in the framework of a lifetime, very exhausting, and also, I think, spiritually damaging way of living. What of course is important about the sacraments is that they anchor our faith in an objective reality greater than our own selves. And they should also anchor it, and I think this is one place where the Catholic Church today minimizes really the significance of the sacraments. The sacraments, of course, come to us both through the operation of God upon the elements from above, but also through elements that come up from the world from below. And, marvelously in the sacraments, the world offers itself to God, and God in his graciousness takes it up into his own life. And one thing I think that we in the Catholic Church are in danger of doing today is lapsing into a kind of extrinsicism of grace, whereby the sacraments come to us kind of Deus ex machina style, from a priest's hands, rather than seeing them as coming up from the earth through the priest's hands, in conjunction with or in union with the life of God. And that the earth itself has its own kind of sacramental character, that it is the original symbol and manifestation of God's nature and character. And we need to recover the sense of that, especially in relation to Jesus, especially in relation to the Lord himself, whom we tend to forget is, yes, of course, our savior and God become man from outside of the created order of being, but he is also at the same time the Logos, who is the most immanent principle within the created order of being, who brought it into existence and sustains it and orders it every moment. And I think that that the failure to do that is one of the reasons why our proclamation of the coming of the Logos, his death and resurrection, sometimes has so little power in the world around us, because the world sees this as some kind of message extraneous to itself. We don't actually present Christ as something which, in a sense, the world already knows simply by virtue of being. That the world already participates in simply by virtue of being. We present Christ as something that comes to repair a problem. You know, that has arisen adventitiously, rather than as that object of our deepest longings from, you know, from the moment of our inception, the inception of our individual lives, and from the moment of the inception of the whole cosmos, whether or not Adam had sinned or not. So there is, I think, a danger of lapsing into a kind of extrinsicism of grace, in the modern Catholic Church, that is probably motivated in the end by worthy considerations. There's obviously a desire to want to afford the world, to accord the world its proper autonomy, not to impose some kind of ecclesiastical theocracy upon it, rule by priests, and deprive people of their proper, you know, autonomy and freedom. But the price of affirming the world and its autonomy that way is also, I think, losing sight of the integrality of the Church's own Lord to the world itself, as its logos, its source of unity and ordering principle.
Right. And the irony being ultimately depriving autonomous, quote unquote, autonomous existence of its own highest meaning.
Exactly, or even of any meaning. You know, that's in that sense, that's the tragic way in which the Church, I think, unintentionally acquiesces in sort of modern nihilism.
Sure. So I wanted to bring in this passage from later on in the article. You write, if this belief was the metaphysical Kool-Aid, and in this context, we're talking about the Tsarist's principle, also by extension, I think all the cosmic Christology. If this belief was the metaphysical Kool-Aid, Bulgakov, who described himself as the only sane person in an epidemic of involuntary madness, refused to drink it.
Right, so sorry, the Kool-Aid there, just to correct you, the Kool-Aid refers to the sense of the world's autonomy, that the world must be given by God its proper autonomy, and therefore there should be no Tsar. And that was the Kool-Aid in, so to speak, in the world in which Bulgakov was living, to the extent that the intelligentsia of late Imperial Russia had adopted an entirely, well, had adopted what was in effect a voluntarist view of the world under the influence of Western modes of ordering, arranging society. And that had become so attractive that even those intellectuals who thought of themselves as orthodox, such as Bulgakov's friends, felt justified on Christian grounds, in agitating for the transformation of Russia from an orthodox monarchy into a liberal democracy. And the point is that Bulgakov, as a result of this vision, so to speak, on the outer embankment, wakes up out of this delusion and says, no, you can't have a political order founded on the notion of sort of unlimited human freedom, or the freedom of the human will, let's just call it that, and still hope either that society as a whole will remain orthodox as but in a more enlightened way, as his liberal friends hoped, or that in fact over the long run, any kind of wide scale faith or belief in the church will be possible.
Right. And just to make sure everything's framed square, it's fair to say that what his fellow both co-religionists and the other revolutionaries around them, what they wanted is something similar to what is being put out by large parts of the post-conciliar Catholic Church. The idea that we can have autonomy and this will be the real flowering of Christian potential.
Yes, it'd be what you would, yeah, it would be in the immediate setting. What they wanted was a kind of British style parliamentary democracy, or in its more conservative modes, or a French style republican system in its more radical modes. But yes, a system that would affirm the more or less complete autonomy of the political system from any kind of theological claim, except on the level of the individual conscience. And only on the level of the individual conscience would theological claims articulated by the church, or the scriptures, or traditional, or however you want to put it, only on the level of the individual conscience could and should those claims be given any reality. And I think that, yes, that would describe that would describe maybe all maybe it describes all of us to some extent in the post-conciliar church. It certainly, I think, describes the logic behind a text such as Dignitatis Humanae, which affirms the inviolability of freedom of conscience, and appears at least to elevate that principle to paramountcy over any other consideration regarding the place of religion in society.
Right. So then I guess how do you square that with the rest of Catholic tradition? I didn't plan on going down this road, but this Dignitatis Humanae is one of those like case traditionalist issues of the church heading down a wrong direction and having a rupture with the old teaching that error has no rights. I guess how do you personally square that and not view the Catholic Church as having failed and maybe the Orthodox have been right the whole time and this is all the fallout of like the filioque? If that isn't too much of a
That's a lot.
departure.
There are a lot of connections there, but I think one of them would be to say that it is not a rupture with tradition, because the church has simultaneously to upholding the notion, let's say, that heresy has no rights, and to give a con to put some sort of concrete flesh on that bone. Augustine had no qualms about calling on the emperor to cast the Donatists out of their church and confiscate their property. At the same time, the church has very often principles in tradition stand in tension with each other for many, many centuries. At the same time, the church can say that she's also always upheld the properness of freedom of conscience, and that Christians could not be coerced into sacrificing to the emperor, or that Jews, for example, as Pope Gregory the Great insisted, should not be coerced into baptism. What I think happens with Dignitatis Humanae is that something of the tension is resolved too much in favor of or too unilaterally in favor of one side of the proposition, whereby a proper defense of freedom of conscience comes, as I said, to assume absolute paramountcy over other principles, such as the obligation of the state or of the political community to render right worship to God, that there is also a political dimension, political in the sense of is something that we do together as a polis, not merely as individuals. That there is also a political dimension to Christian life and to the gospel. The trick is how to, the trick, of course, is how to hold those two things together in any given generation. And, you know, I think you do have to throw the ball back in the traditionalist court there and say, well, are you then proposing that we revert to the Inquisition and start holding public trials that end in capital punishment? If on your reading of what church teaching is, you know, we should be condemning anybody who refuses to submit to baptism or does submit and then diverges from church teaching to the flames. I mean, I think that notion is absurd. I don't think that any person who really holds it can think of themselves as, you know, as really a follower of Christ. So again, I think you have to try to interrogate the tradition and arrive at an understanding of what really the deeper principles are that are being passed on here, and never imagine that there is some kind of simple formula discoverable in the Middle Ages, let's say, which can simply be dragged out of the closet and sort of imposed on the world. And hey presto, you'll have a perfect Christian society. I mean, I've heard people speak that way, and I think that it's a terrible betrayal of the true depth and wonder of the mystery of Christ. And it really, I think, can only leave you wondering how much of the mystery of Christ people who talk that way have actually seen or assimilated.
And it also, one of the things that keeps me up at night is, are these people aware that this is like an ultra modern way to view the world, as if they could voluntaristically impose some sort of medieval inquisition apparatus at the hands of a modern liberal nation state? But surely
It
they haven't
also
thought through that far.
Yeah, but it all, but you're quite right, and it's simply another example of that kind of extrinsicism, of grace that I was talking about before, except that it's the extrinsicism of grace in an integralist rather than a secularist mode. It's Christ coming to the world as some kind of transcendental savior who demands people's loyalty and allegiance simply by virtue of being God, but is apparently powerless to attract them to himself by virtue of being the object of their innermost longings as beings. Each of whom have their origin in him as the source of being and logos. So there is actually, I think, also a perverse portrayal of who the Lord really is in that kind of pseudo-Christendom.
Yeah, that something like God is just like a cosmic Torquemada.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
Yes.
then here's where part of where I get all knotted up is that not, if you're, so in college I was kind of an aficionado of Nikolai Berdyaev. Is that not Berdyaev's critique of czarism and medieval autocracy, that
Right.
this is why we
Yeah.
need to go liberal?
Right. Well, exactly. It is. It is. In a way, that's exactly right. It is, and the question then becomes: How then do we hold both of these two things? Both of these two things, and by that I mean both the duty of allegiance that we owe to cosmic order, and the duty of allegiance, which we also, in a sense, owe to the freedom with which God has that God has given us, both to adhere to and not to adhere to this cosmic order. Both order and freedom have to be held together, in other words. And the conundrum is how to do that, in a concrete historical world, in a concrete politics. I think that there are a couple of things here. I think that in the world in which, let's say, Constantine, or the later Christian emperors, Charlemagne, that the world in which that the world that they inhabited, one thing that distinguishes it, I think, is the fact that their world was the world that had, for several centuries, since the time of the pharaohs and the Persian kings and the Greek philosophers, cultivated a desire for the Logos, for the heavenly king, so that when he came, it was the natural response of that world to order itself under the authority of the one whom everybody already agreed was that cosmic king's earthly image, and representative. That was, so in other words, the submission to order there was a submission freely given. The problem we have is that we too, let's say you and I, as Catholics and Christians of a particular kind, we too would freely pledge our allegiance to this cosmic order and to one who could plausibly present himself as the instrument for realizing it among us. We would do that freely, but our compatriots don't. They wouldn't do that freely, and that means we that leaves us in a difficult problem, because on the one hand, the claims of that order are no less true or diminished. The claims of that order over us and its attractive pull in our eyes is not diminished by the fact that our compatriots don't acknowledge its existence or see its loveliness. And yet, were we to try to impose Torquemada style, but even he lived in a society that was overwhelmingly Catholic. Were we to impose this Inquisition style on our compatriots, we would also be betraying the very one whose order we were proposing to establish, because he would no longer be lovely in their eyes. He would be merely a source of oppression. He would be a tyrant. And so the order, both the claims of the order and of the order itself, and the rights of freedom have to be studiously maintained. And so I think what we're left with today as a church, and particularly Catholics and Christians of a particular kind, our calling is, I think, very much to play the long game and cultivate in our compatriots a longing for the Logos. Most of them would have no idea what that term refers to. But you can't desire the order, the good order, and all of the goods that come from the good order that the Logos imparts without having heard of him. And in that point, at that point, we're sort of at, we're at, we live in a world that's much less available for the gospel, even than St. Paul's. You know, St. Paul could go to the Areopagus and, in effect, preach the Logos and be understood. They could have some, something in common. The apologists, St. Justin and the other apologists, were very much aware of that, very much believed that the Logos of ancient of Greek and Hellenistic philosophy, the Logos whose image the emperor in principle was the same Logos as the church's Logos. Only the church had received this Logos in its fullness, while the philosophers had glimpsed it. We're in a much, we're much, much, much further to anything like a Christian social order or a Christian empire than the apologists of the first or the second century were, because the people we live among have no longing for the Logos. They have no idea, no notion of what the Logos is. And so our first task is to manifest that Logos and cultivate a desire for him. That means talking about him. That means restoring, preaching about the Logos to our homilies on a Sunday morning. That means as a church, understanding that our worship is also, as you know, as Benedict the 16th put it in his beautiful book on the liturgy, ours is a logical worship. It is the worship of the Logos. I'm absolutely certain that he had St. Justin in mind there, whose description of the Eucharist, of the early Christian Eucharist, seems to me to be intended, completely intended, to manifest to the pagans that the Christian religion is the fulfillment of ancient philosophy, precisely to the extent that in the Christian sacraments, the Logos becomes directly communicable, even to the least educated. So we need to restore a sense of the Logos, both to our preaching, but also to our act of worship. Our act of worship must become logical again, not in the rationalistic sense, but in the properly super-rational mystical sense. I think that there is an enormous amount that we could do there as a church, and which, some parts of the church are more aware of the urgency of than others, but I think that's where we need to begin. We need to begin with ourselves, with the way we speak and the way we catechize our children, and the way we worship.
And briefly, could you expand on what that regeneration would look like, at least liturgically? Or did you mean it more just in terms of the domestic church?
No, I mean it. I mean it. I mean it in terms of the domestic church, absolutely. But the average domestic church will have no hope of doing this if they have no good model of it in the parish, or in their bishop and his Eucharistic offering and celebration. So no, I do mean by that. I very I do I mean I think that it is more or less indisputable that a certain secularization of the manner of celebrating the Eucharist took place and was propagated in the church as a result of the liturgical reform. And by that, I don't mean the form of the Novus Ordo itself as a rite, but I mean the way in which we've come to celebrate it. I think abandoning the use of Latin almost absolutely, which is not the intention of the council documents themselves. If you go and read Sacrosanctum Concilium, you'll see that it says very clearly that Latin is supposed to remain the normative liturgical language of the church. And yet, that's almost nowhere the case. It doesn't mean that every Mass celebrated needs to be celebrated in Latin, but there should be, I think, a certain retention of the use of Latin. As Benedict again sets out in Spirit of the Liturgy, precisely because Latin is not merely a language of everyday communication, but a sacred language, a language that connects us to a cosmic realm that transcends the mundane one in which we exist before we arrive at Mass. Properly speaking, of course, even the mundane world that we exist in, as I mentioned before, is simply by virtue of being also a sacramental reality. The original order of sacraments are all the natural things around us that, as St. Maximus the Confessor or Dionysius the Areopagite would say, in themselves are each their own theophany. But as a result of the fall, it's difficult for us to see that. And the whole purpose of the church's liturgy, the whole purpose of the church building, is to remind us that the cosmos is itself, as Maximus puts it, a church not made by human hands. But we'll miss that if the church merely becomes a kind of secularized. The church, her liturgy and her buildings become merely a kind of secularized cosmos. So we need to consciously renew the sense of the cosmic, the sense of the transcendent, the sense of the properly mystical to our worship, both by restoring worship in sacred language where appropriate, by restoring again, where possible and appropriate, the use of that vast liturgical and that liturgical treasury that the church has inherited from previous generations, the exceptionally beautiful responses, the exceptionally beautiful antiphons to Our Lady and other and other such music. Which, I mean, I think all of us agree, lift us out of our own particular moment in time and connect us with something that is that's not just greater and our greater than ourselves, but lovely. This is how we're connected to the Logos, because the Logos is the object of all of our longings. We need a form of worship that arouses that longing in us. That doesn't entertain us, that doesn't distract us, that doesn't amuse us, but truly cultivates a longing for the good and serves as an epiphany of the beautiful. To us. And I think that if we began to worship that way, if we began to worship that way, we would be better able to communicate to a world lost in the absence of meaning what the wonder and the joy of being baptized is.
Sure. Well, let's switch gears briefly, but I think it definitely relates. So in here you have a citation from Bulgakov wrote almost like a play called At the Feast of the Gods. And, he tosses off this line about Midnight Lands, which I took the podcast name from. But nested on each side of that, he makes the argument that the significance of the fall of czarism in 1917 is that he claims basically the dispute between the Latin Christian Church and the Eastern Christian Church has now been settled, because he frames it in terms of it was basically the Pope against the emperors, and he claims that was settled, and now the analogous situation that we're in is the Catacomb Church. You agree with that? And because I guess I feel that kind of echoes with what you were saying about how.
Yes and no. I mean, I think Bulgakov's thinking there, I think, is a little bit elusive. And in part of it, I follow him, and in part of it, I think he was being overly optimistic. Let me think. I definitely follow him in agreeing that with the events of 1917, and really with the whole of the 20th century, and the, I mean, I think there's a very strong degree of continuity between Bulgakov and Del Noce on this, the 20th century as a great kind of civilizational apostasy, the an act of secularization. In the process of which both Eastern, formerly Eastern Orthodox and Western Catholic or Protestant Christendom threw off, emancipated itself from the claims of God. On that level, yes, there is great common ground between us, and I think that in the 20th century, we did see Bulgakov vindicated in that, the mere fact that Paul VI and the Ecumenical Patriarch were able to rescind the personal anathemas that had existed between the Pope and Patriarch since 1054. The great renewal of interest, particularly in Catholic theology, in the Eastern Fathers. And also among Eastern theologians in Augustine, etc., and Aquinas. Yes, I mean, on that level, I think Bulgakov stands largely vindicated. On the other, I think he overestimated the. I think what he might have somewhat naively assumed in those lines, because he does overdraw, I think, the parallelism between the Eastern Emperor and the Pope. I think he could somewhat naively assume, probably out of ignorance, given his location in Russia, that the direction in which the history of the church in the West was tending was towards some complete abolishment of the papal state. And to be fair, in 1917, before Mussolini had signed his concordats with the Pope, that really was legally the situation. Legally speaking, at least in Italian law, there was no papal state left. The sovereignty in Italy belonged wholly with the Italian kingdom. As a result of those concordats, a sovereign papal state was, in fact, recognized as still existing by the Italian kingdom, albeit in extremely geographically limited terms. But Bulgakov's point, nonetheless, remains in effect somewhat undermined by that by later events, because the Western Church, against all the odds, nonetheless did hang on to, in a sense, a form of Christendom. It might only comprise less than a square mile in the heart of Rome, but nonetheless, there is still one part of the Earth's surface where an absolute monarch rules by the grace of God without the consent of the people that he rules. And that I don't think that's unimportant in, obviously the popes don't think that that's unimportant either, or else that they wouldn't have insisted on the retention of this small particle of the patronymic of St. Peter. But it does suggest that there is a certain inequality still between the place of the Eastern Church and the Western vis-a-vis secular modernity. By virtue of still the temporal autonomy of the Pope from any earthly ruler, the Catholic Church can speak with a degree of autonomy from political pressures that I think in the end the Eastern patriarchs might struggle to do. Yeah, I'd probably want to revise some part of what I just said because I don't think I quite expressed the idea that's in my mind as well as I might have liked. But there is nonetheless a certain small but significant inequality, I think, between the position of the two churches even now vis-a-vis the modern regime.
Which is so when he frames it, I read him as almost saying, even well before the 20th century, that basically with the dissolution of like the Holy Roman Emperor and, or sorry, the Holy Roman Empire all through the revolutions of 1848, I guess I read him more saying in that whole range of things, that's when the popes lost control over temporal affairs of Christendom. Christendom itself fell apart. I guess I read him to be more referring to that state of affairs. And then contrasting that with it took till 1917 in Russia. Of course,
Yes,
with Rome and his telling.
I think you can read him that way. I think, on the other hand, if and maybe I read him in a closer historical setting because I know that among his friends and associates in Russia, for example, there were parallels being drawn between the dissolution of the Papal States between 1861 and 1870. And then the French law on laicization in 1905, which again disestablished the church in every way in France, and what those intellectuals hoped would take place in Russia, that the Russian church would be similarly, so to speak, emancipated. In fact, they saw those things as good things for the church in the West, emancipated from this illegitimate and polluting connection with political order.
Fair enough. And then, so if we're not going even further afield, while I was preparing for this, I was digging in my library, and I years ago I read the Mystical Theology of,
One of my favorite books.
yeah. Okay, good. So I could hear Lossky just like scoffing, because my understanding is Lossky never really liked at least the sociology stuff.
Right.
So at least in at the Feast of the Gods, Bulgakov's argument like this was just a political feud the whole time and different conceptions of theocracy, whereas Lossky's position is like, no, this is all dogmatically downhill from the filioque, and then as that plays out, that's why we have like hesychastic Transfiguration theology versus Stigmata's Imitation of Christ, Dark Night of the Soul. Yeah, I guess where do you stand on those questions?
Oh, that's a big question, and I have to be aware that my students might also be listening to me when I give my answer. The way I read Bulgakov there is to say that would be to say that yes, there was a very important political difference between East and West. That nonetheless, the differences between East and West aren't necessarily reducible to that, and that there are substantial theological differences, but in Bulgakov's mind, they don't nullify. Well, in a sense, There's different traditions are both authentic expressions of the gospel at the end of the day. With Losky, I think you're right. The dogmatic considerations are much more at the forefront of his mind, but we shouldn't judge Bulgakov either only by one text. Bulgakov, as you may or may not know, was on the verge of becoming a Catholic after the revolution. Had some very fruitful interactions with a Polish priest in Crimea, and began, in fact, he tells us, praying for the Pope when in, I mean, remembering the Pope, that is, in the Divine Liturgy under his breath as an Orthodox priest, when he then went to try to explore the possibility of a more formal reception into the Catholic Church. He then became aware, in a way I think that would be much closer to Losky's perception, of the difference, of the distinctiveness of the Eastern and Western traditions dogmatically. Nonetheless, you're also right that Losky saw Bulgakov's sophiology as a kind of quasi-Western philosophization, rationalization of God in a way that was incompatible with the fundamental Eastern intuition of God's unknowability. And if I were to answer your question any further, I think I would say that I think Losky's perception there is correct, that there is that the two traditions are very distinctive. They differ in quite fundamental ways in the way they approach God and represent God and his knowability. It's fashionable among particularly scholars in my field. So I am a church historian and a patrologist. So I study the church fathers, and that's sort of what I spend my spare time reading the church fathers where I can and writing about them. It's certainly fashionable, I think, among my colleagues, both Catholic and Orthodox, particularly at the sort of more liberal end of the spectrum in Orthodox theology, to minimize those differences and really to consign Losky and his point of view to the dustbin, as you know, kind of a 20th century anachronism. And I disagree. I think that when I know that, for example, when I teach patristics, when I teach patristics to my students, one of the most difficult things for them as theology students who already have been introduced as part of the normal course of studies for becoming a Catholic priest to one Aristotelian theology and Thomas's synthesis of philosophy and revelation, one of the most difficult things for them to do is to step out of that and understand the premises on which the Cappadocian Fathers, for example, build the doctrine of God and the Holy Trinity, or the premises on which, for example, Athanasius and Cyril of Alexandria build a doctrine of Christ and salvation. You really have to go back to fundamentals, and I've seen the resistance that a lot of my students have to doing that because it feels as though it directly in some ways it threatens to undermine what they hold to be self-evident truths on which the whole certainly Western tradition rests, about God's simplicity and God as being, etc., etc. God as pure act. But I have. To summarize on that point, to summarize and answer to your question, I think Losky's right. There is a real distinction between the two traditions that plays itself out dogmatically, that plays itself out also necessarily, precisely because on the one hand, dogma is experienced, rationalized, and spirituality is dogma realized. That plays itself out in different in often vastly different styles of spirituality. But that, of course, both of these traditions are equally valid and willed by God. So one of the things that we have to wrestle with, I think, always as Catholic Christians is the legitimate is the place of legitimate plurality. The church struggled for centuries to understand how God's oneness, God's essential oneness, could be reconciled with the apostolic proclamation of his plurality. And I think that as a church, trying to live as St. John Paul II puts it through both her lungs, we also have to wrestle with the legitimacy of a plurality of dogmatic formulations and spiritualities, as something divinely willed.
And then by extension, if there's two lungs that have at least somewhat different dogmatic and spiritual realities, does a theocratic principle look different, East versus West?
I think it does. I might just make a small but I think important correction to the way you just to the way you framed it. It's not that the reality, so to speak, is different between East and West. The reality is the same mystery of Christ. It is rather the way in which that mystery is apprehended and approached, and therefore, and then thereafter, dogmatically formulated and realized, that's different, but it's the one and the same reality. Does that have a bearing on this question of the theocratic principle, on the question of political theology more broadly? Yes, I think it does. I think it does because and this is where you'll notice that I am actually very much a Loskian. One of the things that distinguishes the Eastern doctrine of God from very early on is a perception that God is irreducible to his essence. God is irreducible to his essence, and God is not identical with his attributes. Being irreducible to his essence, we can talk of divine operations or activities or powers or condescensions or energies that participate, so to speak, in God's being without being a definition of the essence. Now, Losky represents those energies as Losky, in fact, simply exegeting St. Maximus the Confessor here, represents those energies as being the logos wherein the all of the principles, the logoi, as Maximus puts it, the archetypes. The archetypes of every created thing exist, and the world is created by the logos in order to manifest those archetypes, which are themselves uncreated and part of not the divine. They don't belong in the divine essence, but they belong in the divine nature and the energies nonetheless. And the logos himself, in ordering creation, does this by virtue of his own energy of kingship, his own energy of ruling, his own energy of arranging and disposing, and ordering, providing limits, establishing relationships with things that allow them to acquire meaning, and reflect, allow the whole to become an image of the Logos as he determines himself in relation to the world. Now, because of that, you can, in an Eastern sense, if you understand, first of all, the act of ruling as an image of the activity of the Logos in the cosmos, and this is a point that Athanasius makes in one of his refutations of the pagans in his Contra Gentes, that we should, if we're trying to understand, arrive at what a notion of what the Logos is. The Logos is not merely some kind of disembodied natural law. The Logos is a person. And he is like the king who, in any properly ordered cities, arranges everything for the good of the whole. So the king, in that sense, is the rule, the person, the human person invested with the act of ruling, the activity of ruling, is an image of the Logos that we are, in fact, as people, supposed to receive and be led anagogically to the Logos through. His own act of ruling, however, is only true to the extent, of course, that he's ruling according to Logos. His own power, his own authority is, on the other hand, just a participation in the Logos's energy of ruling. So in the Eastern worldview, it seems to me, there is a much greater readiness, ability to see the earthly ruler as an image of the Logos, and the act of ruling itself as, to go right back to Russia, as a gift, as something that comes from God, that is rooted in an ontology that precedes the world, and is there and is only properly organized, is only properly carried out and executed to the extent in which it conforms to a pre-existent pattern. In the West, on the other hand, I think that the absence of that sense of the world as, well, not the absence, but the weaker, there is a weaker sense of the world as icon of the divine energies, icon of the Logos, and a tendency that I think the historical tendency has been to, in a sense, I hesitate to say it, but almost to secularize the natural law by reducing it to some kind of impersonal series of principles, some series of causes that act almost autonomously, not.
Just to interrupt real briefly, would you ground that, like, because genealogically, does that start with Saint Thomas, or just for the sake of discussion, we're not talking about just modern Western secular societies, you're talking about.
No, we're not. I think it's fair to say that that is true. I think that would be my own working hypothesis.
Okay, close enough. Yeah.
That it is the massive influx of Aristotelian logic and Aristotelian natural philosophy into the Western Church in the 12th and 13th centuries that serves to give the world a kind of natural autonomy as kind of an indirect analogy of the divine being, but not in itself a a sacramental kind style icon of the logos. The absence too of a the absence too of a notion of the divine energies, I think, has the further implication that the ruler who in the West would rule according to logos doesn't do so by virtue of participation in a divine energy, but does so merely by attention to a kind of naturalized reason that is really internal to himself and, of course, present to be deduced from the natural order, but is not. But it's not, as it were, personally actualized by actualized by a personal being whose manifestation, whose theophany it is. So I think that there is, I think that there is a likely to be. And as you can tell, I'm speaking more hypothetically now than I have done at other points, because I'm trying to reason theologically on my feet. But I think that there is a likely consequence for political theology of the dogmatic differences between the way East and West approach, the very notion of God. In reality of God.
Okay. And then if it's not too far to keep extending this, would you then ground the further secularization of Western societies as kind of like apostatizing from a more Thomistic conception of the world? And then we've kind of been circling the drain since then.
Yes, I mean, Henri de Lubac, the great French, theologian of the 20th century. His controversial thesis, of course, was that an essential cause in the secularization of the world that he too noted and lamented in the 20th century in terms not dissimilar from Bulgakov's his rise of atheistic humanism. Forgive me if I'm telling you and your listeners something you already know, but he located an important step in the process of secularization, precisely in Thomas's modern interpreters, the Baroque theologians of the late 16th and early 17th centuries, who, in de Lubac's account, took Thomas's account of the world, which was still, notwithstanding the description I've kind of given of it, then still for all that rooted, highly implicitly rooted in the kind of Neoplatonic sense of the world as a theophany, by virtue of the doctrine of the analogy of being, taking Thomas's doctrine and producing that kind of autonomous naturalized world that I just described, the natura pura notion, whereby God creates the world as this sort of perfectly autonomous, self-sustaining unit that isn't, by virtue of its very being, oriented towards him or completed in him, but relies on kind of extraneous, extrinsic injections of grace in order to be saved. So my answer to your question would be yes, but I would also follow de Lubac in attributing the some important part of the responsibility for this to Catholic theology itself, And that, in fact, that this is one of the things that's too often lost on traditionalist Catholics. Well, a certain kind of traditionalist Catholic, perhaps. The whole point of the Second Vatican Council was to overcome and retrieve a much more organically sacramental understanding of the world, to overcome the implicit or even the explicit secularizing, naturalizing consequences of Baroque theology. And that properly understood, the Second Vatican Council is a retrieval of the church's deepest tradition when it comes to understanding the whole world as gift, and the place of the Logos in the world as its ordering principle and source of unity. Even before the church is, even before the world is, has come to be in the church, you know, and I think that overcoming that dichotomy and trying to eliminate some kind of extrinsicism of grace is the Second Vatican Council's greatest and most important legacy. And you see it in a document like Lumen Gentium.
Yeah, and I guess, and maybe this is a good like vision to try and wrap up the podcast with. Part of how I squared becoming a Catholic instead of becoming Orthodox was to kind of view what I was entering into in the post-conciliar church, and at least with some distance away from like the silly season, was okay. So the church, here's how I view it. Tell me what you think of it. Vatican II functionally, partly by like its pastoral intention, and partly because we live in a world of like late capitalism and liberalism, and that exerts this like riptide on everything we do. So it was this kind of hard reset where it was, let's get back to the sources, the tradition, let's reevaluate everything. That's happening by some people. The riptide from liberalism, the modern world. And then what the traditionalists are advocates for is like, well, let's hold on to the tattered vestiges of the Baroque. And there's some validity there. And as the Baroque crumbles and we're getting this hard reset and then dominated by mainstream society, it's easy to be a partisan for a kind of romanticized past age that had weird beauty and allure. I'll let you comment on that to wrap up the question.
I think that that's broadly right, and I think that that sort of interpretation is fairly well established. You know, I think any assessment of the council as history, the history of the council and the voting patterns of the fathers at the council, bears out your description there of kind of two parties to the church being united in their opposition to the kind of Baroque status quo, which was an intolerable form of modernism for both of them. One because it was too modern, one because it was too modern for one party to that alliance, but also because it wasn't modern enough to the other party to that alliance, operating together to overthrow, so to speak, the Baroque framework of the church's theology, and writing then documents that were capable of satisfying the two parties that had cooperated to bring this about, where each party, perhaps naively, without properly understanding the other party's theology, but perhaps also in a more calculated way, hoping that once the theological field had been cleared, so to speak, they could win the argument for their own interpretation of, let's say, Lumen Gentium or Gaudium et Spes or Dei Verbum. And the history, therefore, of the church theologically since the council has been that of a civil war between these two factions, represented broadly under the banners of, concilium and communio, and identifying with different theological heroes, Rana and Skillebeck, and others on one side, and Ratzinger and Balthasar on the other. I think that that's broadly right. The question, of course, is that, as Catholics, we're not bereft of guidance magisterially as to the meaning of those texts, and it's very, I think, clearly the teaching of John Paul II and Benedict XVI that that are broadly, let's say, communio interpretation of the meaning of the Second Vatican Council is the one that that the Magisterium commends to us, one that is in the deepest continu that is in deepest con well that is in continuity with the deepest tradition, as Benedict puts it, not in rupture with it, and that any kind of hermeneutic of rupture needs to be excluded when it comes to interpreting the council's texts. And I think that that is, that should almost be a given for any person claiming to be a Catholic, because that's the way in which the church has always operated. The tradition is continuous because that's what a tradition is. Yes, let that suffice as an answer to that question, maybe.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much, Spencer, for having me. I hope that it was what you were hoping for, and didn't go over too much tired ground.
No, it's good. It's given me a lot to chew on and lots of, to me, where like reading the stuff like this is so frustrating in a way, is like every article can just be pregnant with like references to whole other books, and you've done the same, and that's a compliment that there's so much more to think and chew on. So thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much, Spencer. And God bless you too for Evarista.